This is the E of Real Estate. My name is René Stevens, I'm your host. And today our guest is Colin Beard, professor at Sheffield University.
Sheffield Hallam University.
Hallam University. Professor Colin Beard is a National Teaching Fellow and a professor of experiential learning at Sheffield Business School, part of the Sheffield Hallam University. His research interests are the multidisciplinary theories and practice of human learning. He's recognized as a leading global thinker, writer, and skilled practitioner in experiential learning. Colin has worked with many organizations advising on learning and development. He's a member of the editorial panel of several leading journals, and also a co-author and author of some best-selling books, including Experiential Learning and the Experiential Learning Toolkit. And there's a new one coming up, so we will cover that also later on.
Yes, I will.
And he's also owner of the consultancy firm Experience the Difference. So, welcome, Colin.
Thank you.
From one of your lectures, I understood that you are also a kind of a facility manager, because you want to exchange the existing old-fashioned light bulbs with LED lights to shine a light on the way of teaching and learning. So could you elaborate a little bit? What stands LID for in your definition?
Maybe I'll use this prop as well. Mm-hmm. So this is the old-fashioned light bulb, which is what we call an incandescent one. So about 96% of the energy required to generate light is wasted on this, so it's a very low efficiency. And so I wrote a paper which essentially was called Learning Experience Design, Time to Throw Away the Old Light Bulb. So it's time to throw these away because they're inefficient, and it just so happens that LED stands for light emitting diode. They are far more efficient, and so I decided to use that same LED to represent learning experience design, which is essentially what my new book is about, except it's called Experiential Learning Design, so there's a slight change in the letters. But LED, for me, is a useful metaphor because it is time to throw away the inefficiencies of human learning, teaching and learning. And the other thing about LED is they last longer, so they are not only more efficient, they last longer, and by that I think really it's best to translate that as long-lasting memory of learning, so the learning lasts longer. And in terms of efficiency as well, teachers are often exhausted by teaching. So with the LED light bulb, it's a win-win. Time to throw the inefficient way that is an exhausting, hard-working way of achieving less. Very inefficient.
Well, so when you would give and I know it is almost an impossible question, a definition of experiential learning.
Yes.
What would that be, according to you?
Yes, now that is quite some task. And obviously, when I do speak around the world, people want to know, well, what is the definition? And it's not easy to give a simple definition, which to some extent you'd expect, because we're talking about the whole human and the human environment and learning from it in the best way. Naturally, that would require quite a complex understanding. However, I will simplify it. So experiential learning, first of all, let me just say that it's essentially when the experience takes center stage, and the design of that experience especially takes center stage in the learning. It's focused around the learner. So it's learner centered, it's experience centered. And perhaps a useful phrase to remember would be, with experiential learning, it's acquaintance with rather than knowledge of. So it's that engagement, that acquaintance with the subject and the material, rather than just knowledge of it. Now, perhaps to illustrate that a little bit more, I will just mention the giraffe effect. So I was fortunate enough to go to Nairobi in Kenya to do some executive management training for intercontinental hotels. So there were managers there from all over the world. And bearing in mind that I'm a zoologist originally, so I have quite a fondness of the animal world out there. And as a special treat, Intercontinental Hotels on about day three decided to take us out to the savannah in Africa. And we were in these trucks and with binoculars. And I remember seeing the giraffe, several giraffe in the distance. Those lovely, you know, long legs and that gait. Beautiful creatures, but it was very hazy because of the sun and the heat haze. So, yeah, they took us all that way, spent all that money, and that was my experience of the giraffe. Now, if I was to tell you that in the safari park in the West Midlands, I happened to have a different experience of a giraffe with my family. So the giraffe stuck its head inside the car, and you could smell the giraffe. You could smell the urine. And when you touched it, you really felt the enormity of the beast. When it moved, you knew it was a big animal. And you saw everything close up. Beautiful eyes, amazing eyelashes. And then this giraffe, so I'm in the driving seat, my daughter is here, the giraffe stuck its head down further, and my daughter had some food that the giraffe was eating. So you saw that. Long tongue, and the giraffe ate all the food, and my daughter's hand was covered in slime, and she looked at me and I said, don't wipe it down the car seat. Now, you can see that here are two experiences of the giraffe. One is from a distance, like the teacher in the distance, and one is an acquaintance with that giraffe that will never ever be forgotten, because it was the smell, the touch, the enormity, the close-up, the eyes. So in some ways, that giraffe effect is what experiential learning is. Your experience of the giraffe is fundamentally different to that haze in the distance.
Indeed. And nowadays, there's a lot of talk about 21st century skills.
Yes.
And I think this is one of them, that how can our learning and teaching way of doing be improved to achieve this more in normal settings?
My own view is that experiential learning is, and has done for some time, is continuing to spread around the globe, almost as a default mode of teaching and learning. And often it will start small, and people doing quite experiential small elements of their broader learning. But when you say 21st century competences, around the world we're beginning to see a strong focus on 21st century competences, and they're partly about coping with the 21st century world and coping with health, mental resilience, all of these things. And many countries are coming up with a similar list of competences that especially young people would really need to acquire in order to move forward in the world and have a successful and happy life. So when you look at all of these countries, so I worked with the Ministry of Education in Singapore some years ago with their 21st century competences. So they were looking at, you know, emotional development, they were looking at resilience, they were looking about looking at things like working in collaboration and innovative thinking, critical thinking. And what we see is that throughout the world, as these are unfolding in different areas, we see similarities. 21st century competence, this is the list. Mm-hmm. So over the last few weeks, I've been asked to be an advisor to the European Union on their development of the 21st century competences. And I look at this and think, wait, you know, I went there some time ago with Singapore. And then I started to look at other countries, Indonesia, and that these common competences are interesting. But what's even more interesting is that every single nation has chosen experiential learning to actually transfer these skills and work with these skills with young people.
Exactly, like you were saying in the example of the giraffe, the environment played a very important part because the environment in Kenya was quite different than over here. Mm. And so the effect of the learning was also quite different. But what happens that we have universities all over the world, most of them are 20th centuries and several of them even 19th century. So we now are using it for new skills to teach people new competences, but the environment, the learn work environment, and my definition, that is the physical, so the location and the building, the digital nowadays, digital work and learn place, but also the social part.
Yep.
So the whole behavior culture thing, teachers willing to change their way of teaching, for instance. Can you elaborate there a little bit about?
I certainly can. My own experience of working in universities, because I still work in a university, albeit part-time. My own experience in the university is it's been a fascinating journey for me to develop a working relationship with estates and facilities managers. We all speak a different language. I speak a language of teaching and learning, and they speak a language of durability, resilience, longevity, furniture, health and safety, people flows. Mm. And it took me a long time to learn their language. And in the same way, it took them some time to learn my language, but I'm the one that's in that classroom day in, day out, teaching. So we had a lot to learn from each other. And I found that fascinating. There were so many things that for me as a teacher needed to happen, but didn't happen. So I was intrigued as to why they weren't happening. So I think what we've seen over a number of years has been a gradual but rather slow evolution of the environment in which we learn. There's this wonderful saying that if you're a fish, the last thing you would discover is the water. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if that's happened to us in higher education. We have not really given sufficient thought to our surroundings, mm-hmm. and yet they are so, as you write, you quite rightly say, they are fundamental to the process of learning. Mm-hmm. The place and the spaces in which we learn are all part of this complex relationship that we've spoken about between form and function. So those two are interplaying all the time, the form and the function. What we do and where we do it influences each other. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed, for example, in my university that we used to have huge corridor spaces. And in one instance, I remember the students actually occupying that corridor space by, I don't know what word to use, but you could say stealing the chairs and the furniture from the classrooms to have this informal space. So they actually decided that they would alter the space and occupy it. And that was fascinating in itself, because eventually we made something of that space for them. But we made it official. That is an informal space that you can use. Mm-hmm. And then we had corridors, for example, that were not being used particularly, just almost a space for flow, but could have had more. And we started to develop what we might call fast food computers, where you could just stand up quickly and log in and find out what classroom you're in at 2 o'clock or whatever. And the whole idea, well, we even had a sign put up to say, you know, stand up computers, and these are just for you to access something quickly. But all of these things have to evolve, because now Most students have got their laptops, so they don't need necessarily to have a stand-up desktop computer. So the space is evolving, but it has to relate to what we need to do and what we want it for, and it has to relate to the things that you were saying. You know, it's not just teaching and learning, but it's about social interaction. It's about, and one of the things that I'm fascinated by is space and place and spatial dynamics. And space is so important from the microclimate of learning right through to the way we occupy space and we interact in space in order to learn. So on the micro side, spatial relations, the way space and spatial issues come up in our language is fascinating. So again, let me give you a simple example. Space crops up throughout the English language. You know, if I say that I work in higher education, that some people work in further education. If I said to you, I'm sure your parents will have said to you, you know, you have your whole life in front of you. We hear managers say, going forward, your parents will also say, you know, you need to put that behind you. So the way in which space is intricately interwoven in our language on that micro scale helps people to think, but on a macro scale, the way in which we design our classroom space, our learning space, the way cafes are now being used for informal social space, well, they say, don't they, space is the new frontier. So it is fascinating.
But are the people in charge of space and place enough involved, and are the users of these space and places, so the teachers, are there enough aware that it is this important part? And how could that be improved? Because you have your own experiences in Hallam University here in Sheffield, that you left behind some legacies in how space is used.
Yeah, I am. I think I was fortunate, but I also made an effort. So I made an effort to get to know people in facilities and estates. And it started with offering them some training on environmental issues and how to make the university greener. And I remember the director of estates stood up at the back and said, "Ring me." And we had a coffee together. And that was the start of this getting to know what I call a totally different tribe in the university who spoke the totally different language. And when we got to know each other, we would interact more, and I'd go to their meetings and we'd talk about, well, what should the future classroom look like? And on one occasion, I was invited by the university and paid by the university to run an event for facilities, estates, architects, IT and teachers. And a turning point on that day, we're talking some years ago, a turning point was when I simply got hold of a pen and said to an architect, "Would you just write your name, please, on the whiteboard?" And when the architect got up, he realized that because I'd shown a PowerPoint slide, down came the screen, and there was nowhere to write. So just for fun, he stood behind the screen and we're all laughing, but it was very, very poignant at that time that there was nowhere to write in a university because the technology was in use, which removed the possibility of the only whiteboard in the room being used. So I then said, "What's on that wall over there?" "Nothing." "And what's on that wall over there?" And somebody said, "Six coat hangers." And I said, "Have you ever seen a student hang their coat on those coat hangers?" "No." So the point I'm making is, why don't we have whiteboards in every possible space? And that was the beginning of changing the dynamics, because whenever we have a dynamic where the teacher is in charge of everything and owns everything and uses everything, but the students sit passively, it's never going to work in the long run. So you can imagine surround sound whiteboards, means that students can use this, students can use this. We start to get more of a different functional dynamic that is no longer just linear. Mm-hmm. Teacher at the front, all the technology at the front, it's mine, use it, I teach. Now, what came next was I saw some glass whiteboards in AIG in Taiwan, and I came back and said, you know, let's try glass. So the estate straight away said, it's not safe, we can't have glass. Well, we've got glass, and we've got different coloured glass whiteboards, and they don't deteriorate like the traditional ones. So, if you like, two of the things that are a part of this legacy of a nice relationship of teachers and specialists in learning working with estates and facilities is one, mm-hmm. whiteboards, two, glass whiteboards, and then three, the idea that we need lighter furniture with wheels, so the desks and the chairs are lightweight, they have wheels, and they can be reconfigured. So in other words, we can reconfigure the spatial stroke social interactions very easily. And this evolution has to continue. We have to, and we have to wake up and realize that we're no longer fish where we haven't ever thought about the water, or in this case, the places that we learn and teach.
Yeah, and you did it in all the classrooms or just a few? And how are your colleague professors are reacting to this? Are they embracing it? Not invented here.
Yeah, fascinating question in itself, because of course, as you'd expect, we have some at the front of innovation and some at the back of the innovation movement. So some people will not know what to do, don't know why we've got all these whiteboards, still want to teach in a very linear way, and still want to do the things they've always done. So I think this front edge, back edge, but also the need for help and support and demonstrations of how to has to go along with these changes, because otherwise you've got the form changed but not the functional change to go with it, not the how to teach and learn and do all of these things. They don't follow together and they have to.
And would be the HR department the one to take hold of the cultural change? Because obviously I think not the estate or the facilities manager or even IT, they just provide the space and the amenities.
I think there's scope for lots of different approaches to develop change. I think the teachers can help the teachers, the HR can do things, I think estates can do things, I think IT themselves could do things, because these days, what are we doing? We're doing a podcast. So it's very easy to develop things and put them online and let people see how to do things and how to use space. And so I think it's got to be a multi-directional approach to change.
Yeah. I think so too. You talk already about spatial ecology a lot, and maybe elaborate a little bit of that space turn into behavior, both ways.
Yeah. So maybe we could have a look at space again from the micro to the macro. So in terms of the macro, what you saw is the students occupying space, and then eventually that becomes formalized. So you get this dynamic between functional and not functional, or formal and informal, and occupied and not occupied. So it gives you a taste of what's going on the grand scale. So you don't have necessarily to design something for it to change behavior. Behavior, i.e. occupation, can change the form and the function. But one of the things I'd certainly like to do is to talk about space more so in terms of how we learn. So I think, and this will be in the new book that I'm writing about experiential learning design. So I remember running a workshop a couple of years ago for some Americans who run elite sports camps. So these are for potential Olympic athletes, and in this case, rowing especially. And they said, we looked upon the internet, experiential learning design, and there was nothing. And it stuck in my mind, and ever since then I've thought, there's a gap there. But they flew over and we had a look at the design of their camps, their elite sports camps, and we mapped it all out rather like the London Underground map. Mm-hmm. And it was, again, rather interesting, but that spatial awareness of what they did in terms of sequence and why they did this was quite illuminating for them. And it was that spatial dynamic that I think helped them to see that we do this, then we do this, then we do this, and why do we do that, and what about... So, you know that the London Underground map is said to be one of the most iconic pieces of cartography that's ever been done. And yet, would you believe it, Harry Beck, who designed it in the 1930s, simply looked at the three cables in a plug and saw three colours and three lines. And that was the basis of his thinking in designing that wonderful spatial thing where you simply say, I need to catch the blue mm-hmm. line and go 1, 2, 3, 4 stops and I will arrive at Buckingham Palace and I can see where the Queen lives. It is wonderfully simple, and it's to some extent a lie because a lot of information has been removed in order for you to navigate. So when we talk about space, we also talk about navigation, and when we talk about learning, navigating and understanding spaces fundamentally important. So if you give me the opportunity just to explain, for example, with simple children's mathematics.
Right.
So let's imagine in our minds grandparents holding the hand of the little toddler. What do they do when they take the toddler up the steps? They hold their hand and they go 1, 2, and the toddler is lifting their legs, 3, and over a period of time, those little children, preschool, learn not only numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, by rote. You think it's by rote, but in fact, it's not entirely, because of course, they're using their bodies. Mm-hmm. So that's a really important principle in learning, the use of the body. We have a body, and it is remarkably important in terms of its relationship with, you know, the brain. Mm-hmm. Mind, body have worked together in evolutionary terms for a long, long time in a perfect partnership. So these children are using their bodies. And again, what people don't realize, and certainly the grandparents, is they are subtly teaching that more is higher. So we go 1, 2, 3 as they walk up the steps. And then they go to school and they're taught mathematics. And the teachers are, these days, are using experiential approaches. And so they'll start with a popular object and they'll start with a popular language. So the children will learn about sharing and they might use sweets. And eventually, they might use solid objects like this. So each one of those yellow blocks, going back to the London Underground, underground and colour, each one of those is 1. Each block there is 10. And this one is 100. So the children move from sweets. Eventually, they move to other objects. And they change the language in school. So sharing becomes division or dividing. And that in itself is fascinating because there are principles there that sometimes even the teachers are not aware of, because the use of those objects is back to space. Sharing is dividing, is moving, is separating. Mm-hmm. And they move from sharing and they learn mathematical language, which is division or dividing. Dividing the sweets, dividing the object. And eventually, the teacher introduces the symbol of division. And my wife, who's a primary school teacher, very cleverly takes them back to the sweets and says, 1 for you and 1 for you. And I've never heard that before. I'm nearly 69. I've never heard that. It's remarkable because it aligns with the original learning of the children. The sharing sweets, the dot there is 1 sweet for you, 1 sweet for you in a line. Now what is remarkable again is that children are moving from popular to less known language to a symbolic language. So they learn that that means division. So they learn the basics of mathematics moving through that sequence. The problem lies in the fact that, hence the reason why expensive mathematics tuition is happening all around the world. You'll see them in nearly every shopping mall in Asia, for example. That process is moving too fast. But the very reason why these are being sold now on the internet and similar other things are happening is because this is experiential. This recognizes the importance of space and recognizes the importance of the hands and hands. So you can see there's some core concepts at work here in experiential learning. These, spatial cognition, movement.
So it would be a huge improvement when there would be more awareness about using the space in a different way.
Yes.
In
fact, there's a paper, a wonderful paper. It's I think it's titled Mathematics Lost and Found in Space. Yeah. In recognition of that spatial.
But yeah, every change is difficult. And a lot, in this case, a lot of people are involved. So the teacher, the students, and all the surrounding departments who facilitate things, like estates, facilities management, ITT, human resources. Finances are always short. Where to start? How to get people more involved in experiential space?
Yeah.
What's your take on this?
I often say to people that you don't have to suddenly overnight move from teaching to experiential learning because you can introduce small experiential activities or experiences within the overall teaching setup. But a simple step is to say, what is it that I'm teaching and how can I adopt that principle that where we started on this podcast, which is let the students do the learning. It's learner-centered, it's experience-centered. So we could take something that we normally teach by telling and redesign small components so that the learners are learning. So this philosophy, let the learners do the learning, is a really important first step, but don't go too fast and don't try and do too much. Introduce small bits. And sometimes what we'll find is that the pointers of design are in the language. So this whole idea of listening to your own language when you teach, the language sometimes reveals the clues for experiential teaching. So when I said to you, your parents say, you know, you need to leave that behind you, or you say things like, you know, I'd love to hear your point of view. So one of the things in higher education that, I sometimes do for critical thinking is to use the phrase points of view. Because when we speak it, your mind will think of points and different points of view. So if you say to, for example, students, to move from the simple primary school example to something more complex with students, if I say, let me show you how to get higher marks in your assignments. Let's take the subject of racism. Yeah. If you give me two points of view and you say it's about colour and that's it, it's a black and white issue, you will fail. Simple as that. It's insufficient for higher education, to use another spatial metaphor. If I show you a shape of a triangle, how many points of view are there? There's three. If I show you a square, there's four. If I show you a hexagon or, what we're seeing is the number of points increases. So if you were to tell me that it's due to this, it could be due to this, it's fear, it's cultural, it's, you're expanding your knowledge of several points of view. And if I drew you this shape, which was basically a mess, that's the way the world is. It's complex. But if you look very closely, often there's little bits where the lines intersect. and these are worth exploring. In other words, when you write your assignment in university, we don't want simplicity. We want you to understand the complexity of the 21st century and the everyday world out there. Mm-hmm. So the design of that involves those shapes, because it was revealed in the language. We're looking for more complex points of view. Mm-hmm. And so it goes on. Often you will reveal the design implications.
Speaking about 21st century, also technology is increasing a lot. We until now mainly addressed physical environment topics.
Yeah.
What about the new possibilities we have with all these IT and enhancements, smartphones, social media, YouTube, you can find everything.
Yep.
Like my children said, oh, I don't know, I don't need to learn it, I only need to know how to find it again.
Yeah.
For instance.
Yeah. I find that fascinating, because again, back to simplicity. Let's take the idea of, should children be using smartphones? So you get this yes or no. And of course the media is all about yes or no. Dualisms, opposites.
Mm-hmm.
Do you belong here or do you belong there? Do you agree with this or do you? And that's why I just said that the world is not like that. It is not yes or no, black and white. And we call these the Western dualisms. They're very typical of Western, you know, philosophical thinking and everyday thinking for a long, long time. And recently, and I started using this in my new book, is this author has used the symbol that is like that rather than this. So it's not a line, it's a curve, a bit like yin yang. And that's to symbolize that it's a more complex relationship between these two things. So if you took the smartphone, should children use smartphones? Yes or no? Should they have them in school? Yes or no? Well, it's back to this, there is no yes or no. The answer is it depends on how they use it. So my son will use his phone to find the answer to things. When I said to some students in class, I'm not sure when Harry Beck designed the London Underground map, within 20 seconds, a student gave me the answer. Why? Because they just looked it up, and there it was, Harry Beck, 1938 or whatever. And so the phone connects and also disconnects, because there's an argument that it disconnects them from a social dynamic. So the disconnect, the connect, also has the curve, the yin-yang. So I think we must be careful to say it does or it doesn't, it will or it won't, it is or it isn't. Life is not as simple as that. And so technology can wonderfully enhance the learning experience. The students use their technology very cleverly these days, but there is a downside. But I would say that back to spatial ecology, back to the brain-body balance, holistic learning using the whole of the sense, the technology has the potential now to go large, to use a McDonald's approach. If we go large with what we call gesture-based technologies, then we really do have some potential, I think, possibly even to liberate the human mind to the next layer. So if we look at this, and I've mentioned this before, this is a piece of flint found on the beach in Norfolk. And that is razor sharp. And I brought it home with me to remind me that spatial cognition took off when humans learned to craft axes and knives for cutting and so on. It's said that the coordination required by parts of the brain, the coordination required by the brain and the hands, the imagination needed to see what the product might look like and how we can craft it by chipping flint, that apparently took us to a new layer of what they called above 8th grade level of spatial cognition, spatial competency. Well, if you can imagine working with big screens in the future, using the brain and the body in almost returning to that partnership to work with new knowledge, and you see this on films like The Minority Report, for example, this ability to work in a three-dimensional way to create an understanding that we couldn't create with this linear, old-fashioned language, which is in itself remarkable. You can see there's some potential there to possibly go, rather like we did with the crafting of flint, to possibly take the capacities of learning to a new level. To me, that's quite exciting.
Yeah, I agree fully. It will change also the dynamics from you have to go to a physical space to experience something, to that it can also be in the digital world or virtual reality even. In medicals, that they operate with a hologram above the body.
Yes.
Or even there's no body, just a hologram.
Fascinating, I think. But as you say, they have to go to that physically big screen, so it won't be like the smartphone that's available to everybody. But I think that spatial dynamic of big space could possibly have a major impact on what we can and can't do. We're almost limited by screen size.
Yeah, I think now you make an important point that indeed those big screens need large enough space, but on the other hand, working together in teams has a different experience than just do it your own on your laptop or a big screen at home or wherever. So there will always be something like educational space.
But as you say, we have the old-fashioned saying that, you know, three brains are better than one.
Exactly.
That social dynamic. One of the things that's really popular in learning at the moment, which again relates to space as well, is that we need to, more often, we need to make thinking visible and we need to make learning visible. And one way to do that is by this team-like dynamic where we're creating things on a big screen where we can all see each other's thinking, where we can say, well, if you put these together, and so that kind of social dynamic of using big space, the big space makes the thinking visible, the big space makes the learning visible, because we're all looking at the same thing, as opposed to trying to interpret, which is what we've talked about earlier. When we speak, it can only be linear, because it only comes out one word at a time. And that's why we've got spatial language in there to help someone to see or imagine. This is the big thing, is it's about imagination. As it moves from my brain to your brain in this linear piece of string, we have to use imagination. And that's where we go wrong. I think you said this, but you didn't mean that. On the screen, there's a stronger likelihood that by making the learning visible, by making the thinking visible, we can see alternative points of view, we can see different points of view, we can share points of view.
Yeah, exactly that, because there's more than one person involved. There are also more points of views, more lenses looked at the same thing.
Yes.
And one question can raise another question. Another insight.
When we think about it, this whole idea of the teacher having all the technology at their disposal, the ability to have that screen where it belongs to everybody, I think is quite important. It's no longer the teacher. If you look at a lot, when I travel around the world, I often look at the spatial layout of the classroom, and it's very revealing when everything's at the front for the teacher, owned by the teacher, run by the teacher, operated by the teacher, and all the students. And in fact, about 33%, 30% of the space is occupied by the teachers, and everybody else is squashed into what's there.
That's your stage. We explore some things about experiential learning, how space is important and stays important even by technology moving, because some say, oh, we don't need those buildings anymore, everything goes online. Partially that is true, but still you will miss something. But to make change happen, that is not easy. It involves not only the student to consume it in a different way, although they are already acquainted with technology, so I think that will easily catch up. But it's the teachers is another thing. The whole supporting departments around it, as we discussed, but also the management board of a learning institution. How could we involve them? So how could we involve the management board in this change?
Yeah, again, I think there are several tribes with different languages that need to come together and make their thinking visible. Mm-hmm. The only way to get this change is to have a lot of the stakeholders involved and have their voice heard. And we need the voices to be heard, because at the moment, I think in many places, there is no voice. People are being like the fish. They have no awareness of the water. They have little awareness of the importance of space. But it's starting to change, and I think we have to keep the momentum up. And teachers need to talk with facilities people and estates people. And it isn't happening in many places, but it has to. If we're going to move forward, and then that then begs the question: if the teachers talk to the estates and facilities people, then who talks to the senior managers who make the decisions? Who talks to the budget holders and the budget, you know, designers and so on? And I think the COVID situation and the teaching with technology has opened up a new agenda. Mm-hmm. What we're finding, for example, is the great advantage of having a lecture recorded for you to watch is that you can watch it time and time again. Mm-hmm. You can watch it when you want. You don't have to go to the lecture theatre and pay for your bus fare and go in and sit at a specific time. But there are other dynamics going on, because mm-hmm. whilst you can watch it time and time again, it needs to be good, mm-hmm. because it's recorded. And it's not in the confines of a classroom with just the lecturer and the students. It's on show, mm-hmm. and it might be available to everybody, and it needs to be good. And on the other hand, students may think that after they've seen four or five, they might lose interest, because mm-hmm. it's the same, what we call death by PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. So the dynamics are fascinating. What we're definitely finding out is that there are advantages, as we said, and disadvantages of using things like Zoom recordings and Zoom meetings. And it's not surprising that those technologies are evolving continuously, with things like chat rooms. They're trying to mimic the physical environment and the social dynamics online, but it's limited. Mm-hmm. It's very limited. I've watched many people in meetings who tell me they've lost the will to live, and because there's no movement, there's just a series of faces on the screen. So still limitations, lots of limitations in the technological world, and what we have to do is to be able to do some of these experiential things online, which require these basic components: movement, use of the body, and so on.
When you would give our listeners an advice, say that sounds very interesting and there are a lot of benefits, where to start, how to start, where can some quick wins be gained to get the momentum going?
I think the first step is to have greater awareness of the way space does or doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I think the change from the linear to the multi-directional, if you're going to say, let the students do the work, if we're going to, then we have to have a spatial dynamic that where all the power is not held in one place, mm-hmm. Because that is symbolic of telling, and death by PowerPoint. So I think we have to start small. We have to start with small opportunities to try more student-centered experiential approaches. And I think we have to have this greater awareness of space. It's so important that it requires our attention. Mm-hmm. And if we don't have our voice heard to, for example, the facilities and estates people, then we're not going to get a design that we want. Mm-hmm. But that then begs the question, do you know what you want? Mm-hmm. So if somebody comes up to you and says, what's your ideal classroom? I think really we should be in a position to be able to articulate that. And for me, in the future, what I'd certainly like to see is not just this whiteboard, 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 because we've realized that one behind the screen doesn't work, one that belongs to the lecturer doesn't work, but I'd like to see big spatial gesture-based technology-enabled screens, preferably on glass, that can be internet enabled in the future. I'd love to have one there, one there, one there. But that's a little way off because of the expense. But the technology is already there. Big screens are already there. Big screen gesture based use of the hands, they're already there.
Yeah, I think this is a matter of comparison. You can look at the cost, but what are the benefits? If you can calculate also the benefits, maybe the costs are acceptable. Because what I see most of the time, the focus is on cost reduction instead of how can we enhance the performance or the outcome. And change has to start somewhere. And actually, I think it can start everywhere. So everybody can take the initiative and search one or more of the other stakeholders. So that can be the teacher, can be facilities management, can be senior management. Would it be a solution when there would be something like a conductor who orchestrated this change? And if so, would that be a new function or?
Well, maybe I could comment on something like speech recognition, which for me is exciting. I remember giving a talk in the British Museum to a big audience, and I must have said somewhere in that speech that, remembering it, that I've had this label as a professor, I must have said that I struggle with writing. And this woman came up to me after the speech and said, have you tried speech recognition? And I had many years ago when it was clumsy and you had to spend an hour or so training it. Now it's 97% accurate out of the box. And I've realized that what's slowing my brain down, because this is very fast, but this is not as fast. And I certainly am not a professional typist. And I was finding that my thinking was going along at a pace and this was much, much slower. And then I'd forgotten what I wanted to say. Whereas if I can just say it. Now, the first thing is that I often stand up and demonstrate speech recognition. And this is what I say. Professor Ron Barnett says the wider project of higher education is not the development of the epistemological self, comma, but the development of the ontological self, full stop. Highlight that. Make it red. Italicize it. Save the file. And audiences often, you can hear the reaction. How did it do that so quickly without any spelling mistakes? And you use big words like epistemological and ontological self or whatever, the wider project of higher education. By the way, that means that the wider purpose of higher education is not just knowledge, it's the change of our very beings and our way of being. So it's a fascinating thing. And people are looking at this thinking, this is the way of the future. So why is it that we're not using it? Why is it that schools don't use it? Why is it that? And people often say to me, how are you able to go to Hong Kong? Or how are you able to go to Singapore? Because we're all still marking. Well, the answer is I've finished mine. Because instead of doing this, I will sit there and I will simply say, Rene, as I open your work, I notice that your layout and presentation is excellent. You have a contents page, blah, 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 and I simply speak it. As I turn to your introduction, you've made it very clear what this assignment will cover, and you have. And the feedback I can give, so I can give maybe six, seven times more feedback in a quarter of the time, that it takes some of my colleagues, and they say, how do you do it? That's how I do it. Mm. And you imagine then, I look at the next piece of work, I've already got a template. As I look at your work, I notice that your pages are not numbered. I work through the same sequence, your introduction, the body of your text, the way in which you develop your arguments, your conclusion, your referencing needs some attention, you're not following the APA system. The pattern is quick. Speech recognition, when used properly, you can talk to your computer and you can control it. You can say, open me Google Scholar, find me an article on whatever, whatever, whatever. Mm. Yeah. Save the file, close it, put it in a folder, open a new folder. The specialist can do that. I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
And when they walk around with a Bluetooth device and they're not even, you see the movement's important again? Mm-hmm. Why do actors and actresses walk up and down when they're learning the lines? Mm-hmm. Why do these people with speech recognition walk around? Because walking seems to free our ability to think. And I don't know whether you know this, but Charles Darwin had a sand walk created in the grounds of his property around his house. And he used to walk around this sand walk so many times and kick a stone when he'd been around once or when he'd been. So, Charles Darwin, the theory of evolution, actors and actresses walking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Socrates, the great philosopher, walked and talked with his learners. Why is walking and movement, back to where we started, so important? Why does GCHQ, almost, you know, top level spy center, extremely important for anti-terrorism, why does it look like a football pitch from above? And the answer is, they built something called the street, and they found that people come out of their offices and talk. So what are we talking about here today? We're talking about the way space changes behavior, way form and function change. Mm-hmm. Their anti-terrorism response has improved considerably because of the street where people walk and talk together. So yeah, the future's exciting, the way in which we design a new space, the big scale technology, it's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm really grateful for your time, Colin, because yeah, as you say, the most important thing at this stage is awareness about the possibilities that are out there, using space in a different way, and then space in the sense of environment, so physical, digital and social. So thanks for your time and for your insights, and I hope that this podcast will help some listeners to make a next step in their process of change.
Thank you too. Thank you.